Readings tonight, and the first one is from Esther, starting at chapter 1, and that's on page 492 of our Pew Bibles. So that's Esther chapter 1, starting at verse 1 and going to chapter 2, verse 4. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet, lasting 7 days, in the enclosed garden of the king's palace, for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink with no restrictions, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abigtha, Zethar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burnt with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king. Karshena, Shethar, Admathar, Tashish, Merez, Masena, and Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles. Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of the king. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands, from the least to the greatest. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in their own language, proclaiming that every man should be ruler over his own household using his native tongue. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. And our second reading is from Isaiah, starting at chapter 52, which is on page 734 of our Pew Bibles. So that's Isaiah 52, starting at verse 13. See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. Just as there were many who reported him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any human being, and his form marred beyond human likeness. So he will sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. Who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. Yet who of his generation protested? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was punished. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, I was thinking about movies this week, and I was thinking about how we judge movies nowadays. If you've looked at press releases about movies and well-known TV series, Netflix series, etc., it's interesting that they don't plug a Netflix series, a movie series anymore based on things like characterization, scripting, acting, directing, any of that stuff. No, they plug them on the basis of one particular factor, money. How much has been spent and how much it's earned. How much has been spent and how much is earned. A great example is The Crown, particularly season one of this Netflix series, which was billed as the most expensive series ever made for TV. That's how they sold the series. They didn't tell you anything about it. They didn't tell you about the quality of the acting or the production or the directing value. They just talked about how much was spent. In fact, before it was released, one of the things that the PR company released to the media was the cost of the Queen's prop wedding dress, which cost apparently $34,000 for one scene. Yeah, it makes you go, whoa, I don't know what it is about our culture. Well, I do actually. Wealth and beauty are what make kings and queens. That's the stuff that make kings and queens in our culture. And it makes sense in a way, because if you're writing a series all about the pomp and ceremony of the Queen of England, well, you want to make sure that your production values match up. What does all this have to do with the start of our Esther series, a new series in this Old Testament book, which most people probably have never read and don't even really know all the facts about? Well, we meet a king in our first chapter, the chapter of Esther. There's five main kind of groups of characters that we're going to explore in this series. Esther's a bit of a pantomime, actually. It's a bit of a drama in and of itself. And the first character that we get introduced to very early on is King Xerxes, who is genuinely a king. The Persian Empire, which he ruled, was by far and away the most powerful empire of the world. In fact, pretty much every part of the known world was ruled by Persia when Xerxes was king. And the opening part of our story includes this overview of his wealth and his power. He stages this display of his wealth, which runs for 180 days. And this is not like a powerhouse museum display. This is more like Kim Jong-il standing in front of the guards as they march past for 100-odd days with all the aspects of the kingdom's wealth and power. And then if that's not enough, he throws this most extraordinary of parties. You pick up some of the details. It goes for 7 days and everyone is invited. Everyone. Literally everyone. Now, I mean, it's not literally actually. There's probably a bit of hyperbole because we know there are attendants who are serving the drink, so they're not invited to the party. But most people, in other words, are invited. And then there's this tantalizing little detail. They can have as much as they drink want. They can have to drink. So this extraordinarily, almost infinitely sized party with infinite amounts of hospitality. And of course, the aim is not to show how hospitable Xerxes is. It's to show how wealthy he is, how extraordinarily wealthy and opulent his life is. And then the writer goes into the detail of his party and his kingdom, and he includes that tantalizing detail about couches made of gold. My couch is made of some kind of material which my kids have drawn on and weed on. And if you've been to my house, we've washed it subsequent to a wee incident. His couches are made of gold. Extraordinary. And that is not hyperbole. We don't think so because Herodotus, the Greek historian, references this very fact about Xerxes, who's a real person in history. He references the fact that Xerxes had golden couches. And the point is, here is a kingdom, and this is the setting of our story. Here's a kingdom and a context which is just overflowing in wealth and opulence. This is not the inner west of Sydney. That's wealthy. This is not even the eastern suburbs of Sydney. This is our next level wealth, right? And that is the context in which this whole story, all the events of Esther, are going to take place. What's also interesting about the book of Esther, you might have noticed if you were a keen listener or if you have read the book before and thought about it, is that God is not mentioned in tonight's reading. God is not mentioned. In fact, he's never mentioned in the whole book. We're going to grapple with that a little bit because that is bizarre. There's a book in the Bible which literally does not mention God once. Does not mention him once. But that is the context. That's the culture in which our story is set. And you might think to yourself, well, that's great, and this is going to be a fascinating insight into Persian culture, 4th century BC. It'll be interesting to see how we can draw some lines between that and 21st century AD Sydney, Australia. And of course, you're right. There's lots of things about Persia and King Xerxes and his court which are just beyond our comprehension and have no real connection to our time and place. But in other ways, in subtler ways, but important ways, there are lots of connections between Persia and Australia. For about 300 years, Western culture has been on a pursuit of getting God out of the public space. So it started about 300 years ago. When we started to think about God, we still had a real place for God. And so we started to think about him as a bit of a distant creator. He set the whole thing up perfectly. And a bit like a clock, he wound it up and let it go and then stepped back. And we've been moving from that. We've been moving from that position all along to the point now where we encounter the world and all the materialism of the world without any reference to God whatsoever. I had a great example of this. I went on a tour to South Africa, a holiday tour, like one of those safari things, and we piled into the combi, my mates and a group of other strangers. And we were going to go off for about 8 days together. And the tour operator turned around and said, you've picked the best tour. This is going to be the best 8 days of your life. I just have two rules for you. Don't talk about politics and don't talk about religion. And I thought, at the time, it didn't really occur to me, but I reflect back now and I think, what a great insight into the way we think about our lives. Consumption and materialism, wealth, beauty, all those things, they're all good and they're just part of life. And religion is another thing, and the two should never really cross over. There should be a gap between the two of them. And we see this actually, we see not just this separation of God and our material lives, we also see a real concern with those twin elements of wealth and beauty in our life. Take the series Suits, for example. If you don't know it, it's set in corporate America, probably New York City, although I think it's filmed somewhere else. It's about a bunch of lawyers who work in an uptown firm. They wear extraordinarily expensive clothes. They have beautiful views. They work with very expensive clients. They go to opulent meetings. They live the high life. They're beautiful people. And in a sense, that show is kind of like an image of what we're all hoping to land at one point in our life. We all kind of want to end up at the high end of town. We all want the wealth and the beauty, the opulence, the ease of comfort, materialism. That's kind of what it is. Now, you might say, of course, well, that makes sense. We're thinking about work and wealth. Work is about generating wealth, so I guess that makes sense that there might be a focus on wealth. But beauty, are you kind of pushing it a bit? Isn't that just a Hollywood thing? Here's what's interesting. I did a bit of a Google about gyms in the city, and this is what came up. This is the first search. But then I noticed that there's actually at least 7 more pages to the search. That was another one, and there's another one. And that's only 3 of the 7 searches. They're all different gyms, by the way. And here's what's interesting. It's the central business district, not the central gym district. But that is a lot of gyms for the city. That's a lot of gyms. Now, if you worked in the city, you'll get this. You'll get it because you and maybe your colleagues are part of that group who pile out during lunchtime, get to Fitness First or whatever the particular franchise that you're part of is, and you smash out the treadmill, you do a few weights, have a shower, and you're back in the office. But it does tell us a little bit about our culture as well, doesn't it? We spend most of our time earning money and the spare time we have making ourselves look a little bit better. See, wealth and beauty aren't necessarily that far off from our own cultural preoccupations. We don't have gold couches. But wealth and beauty are two of the defining foci of someone who's in the workplace. They're thinking about how they can generate wealth. They're thinking about what they look like. The Bible says some very interesting things about wealth. It hits both of these at various times. Jesus in Matthew 6:24 says, "You cannot worship God and money." It's not the only time he talks about wealth, and it's certainly not the only time the Bible talks about wealth. In fact, the Bible has lots of warnings about money and beauty. It's constantly warning about the dangers of wealth and acquiring wealth and going after wealth. But here's 1 Peter. This is another element. This is Peter in his letter to the Christians. He says, "Your beauty should not come from outward adornment. Rather, it should be that of your inner self." Peter's picking up another aspect of biblical teaching on these two topics. He says, "Be less worried about your external appearance." In fact, you could summarize what the Bible's saying on these two ideas of beauty and wealth by saying this: develop inner beauty rather than outer beauty. Grow a rich soul rather than a wealthy wallet. And it's around those two principles, in fact, that you find that the Bible has something slightly different to say to your workplace and your work experience. When you go to work, your primary job is not about what you look like, you see, the Bible's saying. It's about your character. It's about who you are on the inside, about your heart, about the things that you love. And it says, your primary goal in work is not the accumulation of wealth, of a full wallet, but of a rich soul. The point of your work is a place to display and to cultivate a richness of your soul. And as we start our series on Esther and we think about it in the context of our workplaces particularly, there's a challenge for ourselves. Is that how you think about your life in general? And is that how you think about your work? Develop inner beauty rather than outward beauty. Grow a rich soul rather than a wealthy wallet. Now, the Bible's warning on this is on point. When we start to get focused on wealth accumulation and we start to get focused on appearance and beauty and the outward things, things don't always go very well. And we see that happen actually in the story of Esther. That we introduced to the opulence, this extraordinary party, but it's interesting how the story from that context really goes downhill. So King Xerxes calls upon Vashti, who's the queen, and throwing her own party as well. And he says, "Would you come and see us?" He summons them. But Vashti refuses, probably because she realizes that she's going to be made an object. She's going to be treated like a piece of meat. At the very least, she's going to be gazed upon, perhaps something worse. And It's a moment of deep courage for Vashti. I think she's actually one of the most courageous characters in the whole book. We don't really hear any more of her, and that might be a sign of what happens to her. Unfortunately, it's quite possible not only does she just disappear from the court, she disappears full stop. But in light of Vashti's refusal, Xerxes gets very angry. And having spoken to his nobles, his princes, who are kind of like his advice court, they send out this decree, which results in what some people have called a medieval version of The Bachelor. But here's the thing. The Bachelor's got its own issues, right? But this is no Bachelor. When you actually peel away the layers of what's happening in this story and this event, it's much more sinister than that. Because actually what Xerxes has decreed is that young women be kidnapped from their families, taken to the court, treated like an object, treated with all sorts of beauty procedures, who knows what kind of long-term effects they're meant to have on them, then raped by the king, and if she doesn't please him, sent into isolation for the rest of his life, her life. It's not The Bachelor. And it's a pretty ghastly place for us to finish our story tonight. But in some ways, the impact is important because I guess it's reminding us of what happens when culture is so consumed by wealth and beauty. What happens when your world is so filled with materialism? You will use people. You will ruin people. You might even ruin yourself. You think, well, again, isn't that just one of those moments where the cultural reality of 4th century BC Persia is very different to us? And yes, in some ways. We think of ourselves as a sexually liberated culture, right? We are the age of modern feminism. Women have not just the vote, they have broken through the glass ceiling in many spaces. But just think about that and unpack it a little bit. In this age of the sexually liberated since the 1960s, what has grown more than anything else is the pornographic industry. And in pornography, what you find is women not treated with respect, but disrespect. What you find is women enslaved in the power of pornography. You find sexuality twisted and perverted for the power of the dollar. And even think about breaking through this glass ceiling. I mean, that's fantastic. We have more women on boards now than we did even 5 years ago. But just to break through the glass ceiling just exposes you to a whole other different form of enslavement, where now you're enslaved by that great charge of earning more money and building wealth. You might have escaped one form of slavery only to find yourself in another. And that is actually our culture. That is our time. And so when you do have a culture that's obsessed with wealth and with beauty, you do see culture slowly falling apart. But it's not just culture, it affects you personally too. I remember meeting a friend of mine at Burwood Station a few years after we'd both left university. I was still at work I was still working as a lawyer at the time. And we were going in and we were talking, and eventually we started talking about how much he earns. He works at a merchant bank, and he said, "Oh, look, I earn about $300,000 a year plus bonuses." I was earning about $55,000 a year. I said to him, that's pretty impressive. He said, "Oh, the problem is I work 7 days a week, so I can't actually spend it." You see, sometimes being enslaved is very simple. It's very simple. It doesn't need to be subtle or overt. And some people here think, "Oh, I'm just going to go through a season where I'm going to embrace that life. I'm going to smash myself, but I am going to get to a point where I have built my wealth status to a certain point, and then I'm going to be happy, and I'll let it all go." It reminds you of a story, of course, that Jesus tells, doesn't it, about the rich fool who builds his barns only to be called away. But see, it's not even about you might die before you get to use your wealth. None of you believe that you'll die before you get to use your wealth. You all think that you'll live till you're 90, so that story doesn't really apply to you, right? But here's the thing. Wealth doesn't equal happiness, and it doesn't equal health. We are a wealthier nation than we've ever been before. But what's the other stat that's always growing? Mental health. You can be wealthy but unhappy. In fact, most wealthy people are unhappy. And the Bible keeps challenging you to see that when your culture and your vision of wealth and beauty is out of balance, it will not fill you up. It will not. It will destroy you. It will eat you away. You'll be like one of the harem of Xerxes, who looks beautiful on the outside. Looks fantastic. You're dressed well. You've got a great physique. You're healthy, but inside you're rotting away. Your story is rotten, fundamentally rotten. And whatever you wear on the outside, whatever you cover it up with, can't get rid of that rotten story. It can't get rid of it. Now, what's interesting about Xerxes, though, is that it's not wealth and beauty themselves that are bad. That's, in fact, not what even drives him primarily to institute the decree. It's something else, and we pick it up actually in the words of the nobles who counsel Xerxes. You see in verse 18, they say the problem with the queen's conduct is there will be no end of disrespect and discord. This is a really great insight into what's happening in the thinking of Xerxes and the nobles. They're thinking about themselves as much as they're thinking about him. So in some ways, they're not that great advisors anyway because they're self-interested. But this is a very helpful insight. See, the thing that's actually driving Xerxes to produce the decree is not primarily wealth and beauty, but respect. He wants to be valued. He wants to be loved. He wants to be approved of. And wealth and beauty, in a sense, are the tools that he uses to make that happen. You can imagine, you can play it out, can't you? You display all your wealth, people will respect me. They'll understand who's the boss around here. You fill yourself with beautiful people, people will think, I'm desirable, I'm worthwhile, I'm valuable. And it is, in a sense, respect that's driving his misuse of wealth and beauty. Wealth and beauty are not in and of themselves the problem here. I want to make that clear because you don't want to walk away thinking, well, I'm a beautiful person, but that's a problem around here. You may not be a beautiful person, but that's not the problem. The problem is using those two tools to try and achieve wealth and beauty, to try and achieve respect. To try and achieve respect. I think that's the same for many people. You see, in fact, if you're not beautiful and you're not wealthy, you still have the same problem as Xerxes. You're still looking for respect and value and self-worth somewhere. You've just got a different tool in your hand. It might be a different skill set, perhaps. But you're still looking for it, and you're still at danger of making the same kind of mistakes as Xerxes. Because you're driven by respect. I'll leave it to you to decide what your tool is of choice. But it's even more than that. I think the reason why his respect goes toxic here, really toxic, is because Xerxes lives a life and in a culture that has no reference to God. I think that is actually really important. I think that does actually shape the way that Xerxes responds and the decisions that he makes and the voices that he hears and he responds to and follows. See, Xerxes thinks that he's the king and you can't blame him. Look at the kingdom that he's in charge of. He thinks he's the king. But that's the problem, you see, when you live your life without reference to God. You will look at some form of your life and convince yourself that you're the king. Isaiah, in the second reading that Jamie brought to us tonight, tells us about what happens when the king sends his servant, his messenger, his ambassador. He says, when they encounter the real king, king's mouths will be shut. You can have a look in your readings at 52, verse 15. He will shut the mouths of kings. See, to encounter God the king is to find your true place, and that's Xerxes' problem. And perhaps that might be your problem. If you're living your life without reference to God, well, then you're on a very slippery slope, a very slippery slope. But when you encounter God, the first thing it does is it shuts your mouth. It shuts the mouth of kings. It'll shut your mouth too. It'll put you in position with God. But what's interesting is that Isaiah then goes on to say that the thing that shuts the mouth of kings is the appearance of the king. And if you've never read the passage before, you'd think, well, this king, the king's messenger, this guy is clothed with real glory, real pomp, real power, but he's not, is he? You see a couple of examples here in verses 2 and 3. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by humankind. That's so startling. You expect when you encounter the real king, you will encounter someone who is more powerful than you, more wealthy than you, more glorious than you. But Isaiah says actually the appearance of the king when he comes will be one of humility and lowliness. And of course, he's talking about Jesus Christ. And when you go to the New Testament, one of the things I was struck at this week as I was reflecting on this passage was that the New Testament spends a lot of time talking about Jesus' appearance. And all the time, they're fascinated by the poverty of Jesus Christ. Philippians 2, talking on the very form of man. He became a very servant. When he arrives, when he's born, Luke says he was in swaddling clothing. He emphasizes the appearance. You know, the reason Jesus comes like that is very purposeful. He comes because he's coming to represent us. He's coming to represent us, to be both God and man in that point. And that's very humbling. See, you might be someone who's covered with wealth and beauty, but deep down you are spiritually bankrupt, you are spiritually malnourished. And when Jesus comes, himself poor and lowly, he's reflecting something about our own poverty, our own spiritual poverty. That's what you truly look like. But Jesus coming like that offers you the most extraordinary opportunity. Because Jesus says, I'm willing to lay aside all my glory. That's in fact what he's done. He does have all that glory. He does have all that pomp. He does have all that circumstance. But he says, I'm willing to lay that aside. I'm willing to lay aside all my value, all my beauty, all the things that should naturally come with one who is the Ancient of Days, for whom all things were created and through whom all things were created. I'm willing to lay that aside so that you can actually feast on what's truly, truly filling, so you can fill up on my real riches, so that you can inherit my riches, so that you can be clothed in my righteousness, so that you can find true value, true beauty, true assurance, true love, so that you can be truly beautiful. And Jesus says, if you're willing to come to me and let me lay aside my beauty for you, I will make you truly beautiful. I will make you truly worthwhile. I will make you truly lovely. Are you ready to do that? That's the only way you'll find it. It's the only way you'll find that true beauty, that true loveliness, that true value, that true worth, if you let Jesus lay aside his worth and value for you. That's what the cross is about. That's where it happens. Where he lays it all aside for you. And people who believe that, they're just different people. You see, when you come to believe it, and the more and more you believe that Jesus Christ did that for you, it really does change you. First of all, if you recognize that Jesus is clothed the way you should be, it humbles you. If you recognize that truly you are spiritually impoverished, you have nothing, it humbles you. It stops you from thinking that you're better than you are. It means when you walk into a place, you realize you are the poorest of poor in that space, regardless of whatever you're clothed by. It humbles you. But secondly, it gives you a deep assurance, doesn't it? Because it means whatever you're wearing, however you're clothed, the reality is Jesus Christ has clothed you with his righteousness. He has loved you with his life. He has given his life for you. You are deeply loved. You are worthwhile to him, if not to anyone else. And people who are like that, people who have this extraordinary balance of humility and yet assuredness, they are striking. In fact, they're actually really attractive people to be around. You see, you suddenly find that you actually have that inner beauty and that richness of a soul. And it's not come from anything that you did. It's been a gift that's been given to you. And so it's locked in and it's sure. And the real challenge for us actually is when we go into our workplaces to be people who are that kind of attractive, who carry with ourselves that kind of wealth and value. So that when people encounter it, they ask this question, why? Why can you be beautiful? Why can you find such personal sense of worth even though other things in your life don't always seem to line up? And the answer is Jesus Christ has given himself for me. Let me pray. Jesus Christ, given for us. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your Son who came not with pomp and splendor, but in lowliness and humility for us. Father, we want to accept his gift and feast on the riches of his mercy and find the assuredness of your love. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.